listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. As usual, we have a lot to cover, but let's start with Jimmy Morales, the comedian turned president of Guatemala.
Yeah, Guatemala's interesting, Don, because over the last few weeks, they've done a couple of things that you wouldn't expect a U.S.-friendly right-wing government to do. One of the things that they did about 3 weeks ago now was they abstained in a vote against against Nicaragua in the Organization of American States, where the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, you know, if you can still call them that, presented what they called their final report, when their investigators actually in Nicaragua had barely even started their investigation. I'm not sure if they had even started their investigative work in Nicaragua, their team of independent investigators, but they don't need proof. They'd already written up their final report based on opposition human rights organizations and opposition news media reports. Right. And so the IACHR presented that farrago to the Permanent Council of the Organization of American States, and as expected, all the U.S. allies voted in favor of accepting the report, except for Guatemala. And then when you look at that, when I was a bit puzzled about that, and I looked at that again, and it became clear that the context of that was the government of Jimmy Morales was extremely resentful of U.S. attempts to set up a kind of parallel legal system, a parallel government in Guatemala, which was, you know, and ironically, that's how Jimmy Morales came to power. The reason he came to power was because the previous president,
right,
Otto Perez, I think his name was,
yes,
was ousted as a result of corruption charges, largely as a result, almost principally as a result, I'd say, of the UN Commission for the Investigation of Corruption and Impunity in Guatemala, which is called CICIG under its Spanish acronym. So CICIG back in those days was part of the structure that helped shoo in Jimmy Morales as a kind of different kind of flavor of the Guatemalan elite to Otto Perez. Jimmy Morales took power, and then he found himself subject to the same kind of harassment.
Right.
As I think is a legitimate word to use.
Yeah, and it only took a month, you know, because he took it. You know, the statement came February of this year against the findings against Venezuela, and in March, the IACHR released a report on Guatemala.
Right. So the situation there is that there's a, same as in the United States, there are continuing internecine turf wars between different sectors of the elite, in this case in a much smaller country, obviously. But basically the pattern's the same as in the United States. You have this kind of turf war, right, between different sections of the elite, sections that are more aligned with United States interests, sections that are only aligned with United States interests insofar as that's good for them, like, right, Jimmy Morales and his backers, who are largely associated with the Guatemalan military. And so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is, in fact, legitimately claiming that the CICIG body, this anti-corruption UN body, is being manipulated by the United States, creating a parallel, effectively a parallel structure that challenges the institutional legitimacy of Guatemala. And that's true.
Right.
You know, and so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is actually telling the truth, you know, which is,
right, yep,
perhaps not a first in Latin America, but it's certainly unusual, you know. Right. And so they have taken this line, but that also reflects some, in part, that just reflects the internal reality in Guatemala, where there's a large middle class lobby that is anti-corruption, but that is still kind of, it's a bit like the human rights, the way the human rights motif is used to manipulate,
right,
liberal and progressive opinion in the United States.
Right.
You know, and they, yep, and whenever a country becomes a target for regime change, the first item that comes up on the psychological warfare agenda in the corporate media is the human rights motif.
Right, the second is corruption. And corruption is the second one. And the both are, you know, corruption more so, but both are, you know, non-ideological complaints, although they might come dressed as, you know, being of one or another ideological hue. They're essentially non-ideological. They allege a pattern of fact pattern of wrongdoing that, you know, among a certain group inside the political class, and that authorizes or enables or sanctifies some extra legal or extrajudicial action to remove or negate those players.
Yeah, and in the case of what United States policy in the region, and although it's a kind of a very, you know, well-worn cliche, I mean, what you need to look at in the case of U.S. policy in the region is what are the corporate interests involved? And if you look at what's going on in Guatemala, there's obviously a kind of struggle between those parts of the Guatemalan elite that want to facilitate U.S. corporate interests and other foreign corporate interests, and the kind of nationalist right-wing part of the Guatemalan elite that wants to defend their own share of the pie, right? And so, and you can see that across the region. You see it in Brazil. Why did Eduardo de Cunha get locked up, for example, who was the right-wing president of the lower house in Brazil, who facilitated the coup against Dilma Rousseff and subsequently facilitated, along with the usurper president, was it Michel Temer, the abuse of the judicial system against to prevent the candidacy of Lula da Silva. And why is he in jail? Presumably, and this is just speculation on my part, but presumably because although he was an extreme right winger who to some extent facilitated the US agenda, the political agenda, he seems to have been unwilling to facilitate the corporate agenda of a wholesale selling off of Brazil's patrimony to US corporate elites, which is what is happening under Temer and what is likely to continue to happen should a right winger get elected in the elections in October in Brazil.
Assuming he doesn't get stabbed.
Sorry, Don.
Assuming that particular right winger doesn't get stabbed.
Well, yeah, and
we
yeah,
but
and,
that,
and
so
what was that all about? You know, and that incident in which the right wing favorite, when I say that, I mean the most likely right wing politician to win the Brazilian election. He was stabbed in a very strange incident, apparently by somebody who believed they were acting on the word of God.
Right.
So, you know, and how seriously does one take that? It's impossible to know.
Right.
So then looking again, I'm taking that corruption issue that has been the motif around which the United States has tried to manipulate politics in Guatemala. And staying in the Central American region just for a moment, the reason that that's interesting and that the way the dynamic that's playing out is interesting is because that definitely has implications for what the United States can expect to achieve if it decides to go ahead and implement increasingly severe economic sanctions against Nicaragua, which seems likely. Now, my thing about that is that it's different now. In the 1980s, they were able to get away with those sanctions because Nicaragua wasn't as integrated into Central American economic life as it is now in regional terms. But we all saw what happened when around 400 truckers from across the region were held hostage by the opposition gangs, the violent opposition gangs here during the crisis between April and July of this year. The opposition gangs held hostage around 400 truckers who were responsible for something around 250 of those big articulated trucks that are the actual lifeblood of trade throughout Central America in this region. And so when that happened, what was the result? And after about a month of that, you had the respective ambassadors of the Central American countries complaining to the mediating bishops who were supposed to be mediating the crisis here in Nicaragua about that. And they explicitly stated the damage that was doing to their own economies.
Right.
Okay? So things are different now. And then if the United States attacks the Nicaraguan economy, there'll be knock-on effects in the local regional economy that they have no control over.
Right.
And so maybe they don't care. I mean, they certainly don't care about migrants. They, you know, and some people argue that the United States won't go hell for leather for economic sanctions against Nicaragua because they don't want to worsen the migrant crisis. Well, that seems to me completely stupid.
Right.
What? The corporate elite suddenly developed a conscience about ordinary people in Central America.
Not only
that's
that.
Ridiculous. So, but what is likely to put a brake on U.S. attempts to damage the region is precisely this kind of nationalist feeling Jimmy Morales' decision to refuse to accept the renewal of the CICIG, UN anti-corruption body. And that is an expression of the kind of Central American reality that now exists. And if you want to if you were to deliberately set out to damage the Central American economy, what you'd do is target Nicaragua, because that is the kind of, it's where everything goes to and fro between the rest of the region.
Right.
And the rest of the region, and the rest of the region is Nicaragua's biggest trading partner. So they are the ones that are going to be hit hard by any sanctions against Nicaragua imposed by the US government.
Right.
Let's see how that pans out. Will it make a difference? I don't know. But things are definitely different now in those terms.
Yeah.
And so then when looking at that, and that makes me think about the larger regional reality, which seems to me, and I'd be interested to know what this looks like from your point of view, Don, because to me what it looks like is, we talked about this back in 2015, just after the Argentinian elections, when Mauricio Macri was elected by barely 2% of the vote. He just squeaked through. Why did he squeak through? Because, as usual, the Social Democrats held the door open for him.
Right.
This guy Sergio Massa, who's nominally a Peronist, but he has this strong Social Democrat wing, and they decided to divide the opposition votes, and that opened the door for Macri.
And we saw that actually in the Congress there as well. After Macri got elected, it seemed at first that the left had a sizable majority, but we found out that some of those people were actually voting with Macri's people as soon as they convened.
And that was Sergio Massa. And now what's happening? Now Sergio Massa is desperately trying to distance himself from what he made possible. And Sergio Massa and his Social Democrats are the people that shooed in Macri and shooed in everything that Macri represented, which is economic crisis. And they immediately implemented, just as we said back then, you don't even need to be an amoeba with half a brain to be able to work out what's going to happen with the election of Mauricio Macri. He implemented neoliberal policies, sold out the country's national interest to the vulture funds on Wall Street, brought in, he's now bringing in the army to carry out domestic policing duties. He's reached an agreement with the United States military so that they can have a base in Argentina. Everything that you associate with the right-wing dictatorship from 1976 to 1983, or whatever the actual dates were, and Mauricio Macri is bringing back. And he's also brought back, with a vengeance, the economic crisis of 1999, 2000, 2001.
Right, exactly. That was, we had said back when Macri got elected, and essentially then, it was only after he was elected, laid out, you know, or indicated where he was headed with the economic program, that this was going to lead to exactly the crisis that led to Nestor Kirchner coming to power and repairing and, you know, revitalizing the economy, and which continued with Cristina's administration. And what happened? Macri came in. They basically have precipitated a crisis, and the country's almost in the same position that it was back then, with the IMF even saying
it's worse now.
Yeah.
It's much worse now.
And it took 3 years.
It doesn't look like it on the surface, but it's actually, and if you look at the figures, and the national debt's worse, and the economy is in a much worse state, and it's just, and then when you look at that, and let's put that in the wider context, along with the Central American stuff. And if you put all that in the wider context and look at what's happening in Brazil, and what's happening is that the United States corporate elites, who currently have a kind of sales representative selling some flavor of their interests, Donald Trump, but what they are after in Latin America, they know that time is running out for them. They've lost Eurasia. They're trying to consolidate themselves in Latin America, but they can't do it in a democratic way on the basis of the policies that the governments they put into power are putting into place. So you see in Brazil a frantic rush to sell off the public sector resources,
right,
to allow the United States military to participate in Brazilian security policy, and even in their aerospace policy, because there's this very important space station, which is the only space station owned by a sovereign Latin American country in Brazil. And they launch rockets into space. And the United States is taking steps to make sure that they have control of that base. And so in every sense, Brazil's sovereignty and its national patrimony is being sold off to the corporate elites and that will control those resources directly, and to the U.S. military, which is itself controlled by the corporate elites, yeah. You know, the armaments industry and so on. Yeah. And so what's going on is that the United States is in a race against time to extract every last bit of Latin American resources that are worth anything in the period of time that they have left before they stop being a global superpower.
Yeah.
And that's how long will that take? Will it take 3 years? Will it take 5 years? Will it take 10 years? Nobody knows, but that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And the corporate elites know that's what's going to happen. And so that's why they're hammering Latin America and sticking their kind of claws into it to extract as much of Latin America's resources as they can over the next 2 or 3 years. And what does that mean in political terms? How does that translate in political terms into events in Argentina? Well, what you've got there is you've got Sergio Massa trying to displace Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner with the assistance of the extreme right wing and their corrupt judiciary. So he's hoping to become the kind of pseudo-progressive front runner in Argentina, who will then take over from Mauricio Macri. But what will be his role as a social democrat? His role as a social democrat will be to extend the period of resource extraction right. available to U.S. and other corporate elites.
Right.
You know, that is the political reality in Argentina. And if you look at what's going on in Brazil, you have the same kind of process.
Right.
That guy who was stabbed, not seriously injured, who's the main right-wing front-runner for the Brazilian presidency, what is going to be his role should he win? The same, to facilitate continued extraction of Brazilian resources for U.S. and other foreign elites. And you can see, and why... why are we likely to see a tremendous offensive against the re-election of Evo Morales in Brazil? And why do we see in Peru this corruption crisis, another crisis around the corruption motif? We see it because the United States, there will be an attack against Evo Morales in Bolivia. But what's going on there is that Peru and Bolivia have the best relations that they've ever had since the 19th century, is what Evo Morales described the situation as over the weekend. And why is that? You have a right-wing government in Peru. Why are they developing good relations with what in theory should be a target country for them, given the fact that they're a U.S. ally? Well, they're not just a U.S. ally. Peru has a strong projection into the Pacific, across to Asia, as does Bolivia. And they are beneficiaries of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Right.
Because as we've discussed in program after program, they are the ones that are developing and promoting the transcontinental railway that will transform trade and economic realities in South America and shift the balance away from dependence on the North and the United States, and towards a much closer relationship, a win-win relationship, not a dependency relationship, but a win-win relationship,
right.
Both sides benefit, with China. That's what that is all about. And that is why you can see this attack developing against manipulating the corruption motif in Peru. And that is why we will see an all-out offensive against Bolivia when the elections come around next. I think it's next year. In the same way that we've seen an assault on Nicaragua to try and overthrow the government here and attempt regime change, as they've done in Venezuela And where else have they done it? Ecuador, of course. I mean, right. We could just, there's so much to talk about, Don. Right. And just look at Ecuador in that context.
I know. And
do I mean, we have they elected, time to talk
they
about
elected a guy to do something and to, you know, to follow a particular line. That's what he said he was doing. That's his whole career up to that point. He was groomed for the position to continue the work that you know had been well underway for how many terms did the previous president
Rafael Correa.
Yeah,
two,
right? So he was supposed to be like the next term following the same program. The minute he gets in, he turns face. Now he's withdrawing from ALBA. Go ahead, go through this stuff. But he's, you know, Julian Assange has to worry, for example.
Yeah, and when Lenin Moreno took over in Ecuador, it was actually apparent in the second part of the presidential campaign, because he only won on the second round, and he didn't win by a very big margin either. But in the same way that in Argentina the right wing mounted a successful campaign, claiming that the economic slowdown was due to progressive policies there, and that's what the right wing did in Ecuador. And so they intimidated somebody who's an extremely weak individual in moral terms, Lenin Moreno. They intimidated him into doing a turnabout and essentially betraying the platform on which he was in theory elected. And so he began instituting austerity. He set about to in an unconstitutional way, in the same way that the judicial and legal system and constitutional system have been abused in Brazil and Argentina. He abused Ecuador's constitutional arrangements. He held a referendum that should have been ratified by the Supreme Court, but never was. So essentially, everything that he's done since then has been illegal, in strict constitutional terms. But he's rigged the courts. He's got this provisional transitional body, to which he has nominated, via his proxies, people that do what he says. Right. And essentially what he asks people to do is what the right wing tell him to do. So now he's instituting austerity policies because his economic formula has failed to do what he said it would do. He's threatening to, or he hasn't actually threatened to, but all the signs are in as many words. But all the signs are he's going to hand Assange over to the United Kingdom authorities, which is essentially a long prison sentence in the United States for Julian Assange. He's withdrawn from the progressive ALBA bloc of countries, and that means that he's almost certainly going to start attacking Venezuela in the Organization of American States, something which to date he has refrained from doing. But that's just the next step. And he's also withdrawn from UNASUR, which is the Union of South American Nations, which is the main body in South America, right, that has fomented a kind of a non-ideological integration, but now the right wing have politicized that. Colombia has announced its withdrawal from UNASUR. Right. Ecuador is likely shortly to withdraw from UNASUR. And so you have this whole series of decisions, and the latest is that the government of Lenin Moreno seems unwilling to contest a judgment by what's called the permanent tribunal for arbitration, that although it's based in The Hague, it's not actually, it doesn't have anything like the prestige and authority of the International Court of Justice.
Right.
But this permanent arbitration tribunal has just issued a judgment in favor of Chevron, the big oil company, which the Ecuadorian government under Rafael Correa had sued for damages, right, by Texaco over many years.
Right.
And then Chevron subsequently took over Texaco, right?
Right.
And Chevron are arguing that they're not liable.
Right.
But the Ecuadorian government has argued that, of course, they're liable because they took over the company,
right,
that was responsible for $1 billion worth of pollution.
Of damage.
Now, here's
the big pile of money that you made destroying our country. Now you own it. Oh, so the people who suffered have no claim to it because it switched owners.
Right, yeah, and the Ecuadorian government should be challenging that.
Right.
They should be appealing it.
But they're not.
They should be doing everything possible at an international level, and they should even do what China did.
Right.
Do you remember that judgment that the same tribunal issued against China in the South China Sea? Well, what did China do? They just ignored it.
Right.
Well, Ecuador could do the same.
That's right.
You know? And so, but they're not. And apparently what they're right. saying is that they're now going to have to sue Rafael Correa
right.
to get back the money that they're going to pay to Chevron.
Mm-mm-mm.
Right?
Mm-mm.
So, and that's amazing. You know, that just shows you the extent. As far as one can see, Lenin Moreno's days are numbered, because his credibility, his popularity ratings in Ecuador haven't yet reached the same level as Mauricio Macri, but they soon will.
They're headed south for sure. We got about a minute left. And so which of these other items do you want to give us a very quick treatment of?
Well, I mean, the encouraging thing is in Venezuela, where they seem to, however, their economic reform measures, especially their currency reform measures, are likely to pan out over the next 2 or 3 years. They seem to have taken a decisive series of steps that are going to transform their economy and make them much less vulnerable to the kinds of sanctions and pressure through economic and financial structures dominated by the United States financial elites and their allies in Western Europe. And that's extremely positive for the region.
Yes,
I mean, it may not
yes.
work out 100% as people hope, but it's certainly a beacon of hope.
Yep, it's a start for sure. And Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak with you next week, and maybe we can work that a little more when we get to it next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Millions trapped in Idlib facing death. This Guardian headline was typical of the Western media coverage just before the leaders of Russia, Turkey, and Iran got together to discuss the future of the last opposition-held stronghold in Syria. Did the meeting in Tehran eliminate the danger of an imminent bloodbath? And was it ever on the cards? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alexei Khlebnikov, Middle East expert at the Russian International Affairs Council. Alexei, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, I'm sure you watched the broadcast of the Tehran meeting, which was quite unusual in a sense of allowing all of us a glimpse of how global leaders tangle with one another behind closed doors. Let's watch a clip of what happened at this meeting and then discuss it.
If we declare a ceasefire, this will be a victory for the summit and the most important step in the process. We'll give peace of mind to civilians.
But we don't have representatives of the armed opposition at the table, let alone al-Nusra or ISIL. The president of Turkey is right. That would be good, but we can't speak for them, especially for the terrorists of al-Nusra or ISIL.
So a bit of a friendly bickering on the part of President Putin and President Erdogan. President Erdogan later refrained his request into, let's call on all the bad guys to lay down their arms, to which everybody eagerly agreed. I wonder, though, how do you interpret that? Was that all theatrics in front of the TV cameras, or was it a genuine effort on the part of President Erdogan to get a little bit more out of this meeting?
Well, in the first place, even if we hypothesize and think that it was actually staged, in reality, it reflects existing disagreements between all parties. I mean, it's impossible to believe that all three, Russia, Turkey, and Iran, have agreed on everything so far. So, of course, it's not true. So, and this episode, tiny episode, gives us some idea about, like, real disagreements between Russia and Turkey. on Idlib.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of our colleagues here in Moscow suggested that this was a good cop, bad cop routine played out by Putin and Erdogan to, on one hand, maintain the credibility of the opposition, and on the other hand, to buy Erdogan a little bit more time. The question is, why would Turkey need more time in Idlib, and is there any credible opposition left in that province? Because from the Kremlin's perspective, everybody who wanted to reconcile with either Syria or Russia have already done that in other provinces. The only people left in Idlib are the diehards.
Starting with the second point, yeah, I mean, it depends on who you are and how you treat and how you define who are the moderate opposition and moderate rebels.
But it's not even about the moderation of the opposition. It's about whether or not these people are ready to talk. And from what I understand, there have been several statements by the leaders, militant leaders mm-hmm. on the ground. They're not ready to negotiate. They want to, as I said, die hard.
Yeah, I mean, during the Syrian conflict, we always, in every stage, and in every year, we saw such groups, and from Moscow's perspective, 95% of those groups are not inclined to negotiate and to talk, to pursue political process. So, and I think it's actually not matter if we talk about the summit. What matters here is Russia-Turkish relations and their partnership in Idlib. In the first place, Russia understands that for Turkey, it's one of the most important parts, and it can just push it and impose its own will on its partner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would partially both agree and disagree with you, because I do think the relationship with Turkey is extremely important, and we will talk more about that. But I also think Russia genuinely cares about what happens to the people of that province, and I think this is one valuable thing that we got out of the summit, a very explicit declaration by all the three leaders that they will try to take a lot of care in trying to protect the civilian lives. And we are talking about more than 3 million mm-hmm. people living there. But from what I understand, it doesn't mean that Russia, Syria, or Iran, for that matter, would refrain from narrow strikes aimed at the militants' infrastructure. Is it possible to separate the two, to go after the terrorists and fully spare the civilians?
Okay, I think September 4th, it was the first series of airstrikes in weeks. So when they targeted Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS targets outside of populated areas. So, and in fact, after that, we didn't hear much of accusations from the Western side and from Turkey.
That's
or
true,
someone.
But I think one of the things that many observers note about the Idlib province is that it's very densely populated, and one of the tactics by terrorists mm-hmm. is to essentially mingle
Human
with the
shields,
civilians. So
yeah.
Even if Russians or the Syrians try to spare the civilian lives as much as possible, I think I would assume that the terrorists would try quite the opposite.
Yeah, and historically, during the war, we saw that human shields are used, you know, almost in every serious case, in Dera, in East Aleppo, in Eastern Ghouta. So that was plenty of such cases. And of course, I mean, during the civil war and during military operations, it's almost impossible to avoid collateral damage, as it is called. And Russia in the first place and partners, they also, and Turkey as well, they all want to minimize possible casualties among civilians and also among militants, because that would actually increase another refugee flow, which will go where? Towards Turkish borders.
Exactly. Now, social media, especially Western and Turkish social media, are filled with assertions that Putin brushed aside Erdogan's request for ceasefire in terms of at least backing it formally. But I think, practically speaking, Russia has no other choice but to accommodate Turkey in that request, specifically in order to prevent this massive exodus of the civilians. Do you think that large-scale assault in Idlib was ever on the cards?
Let's put it this way. The assault is on the table, that's for sure. But the degree and the character of this assault is still to be defined. So basically, that what was one of the reasons of the summit gathering. So the three parties aim to decide what limits will have this assault will have. But as we see, I mean, they postponed the assault. That's one important outcome. And secondly, I mean, it's not out of agenda completely. It's but still on the table. And those September 4th strikes and this gathering of Syrian military on the border of Idlib province also confirms that almost all preparations for possible offensive are complete.
Now, I think you would agree with me that what Russia is after in Idlib is not just a military victory. It wants to use that military victory as a transition to a full-scale revival and rebuilding of Syria, which would involve the return of the refugees, hopefully the return of the international investors to help in reconstruction. Don't you think it's a little bit naive on the part of Moscow to believe that if it plays in good faith and accommodates or tries to accommodate everybody, that, you know, everybody else will respond in kind and will actually allow, if let alone assist, the full-scale rebuilding of that country?
Yeah, there is no reason to believe that that will happen exactly how you describe, because during the three previous cases with three other de-escalation zones, everything worked quite oppositely. Quite harsh offensive, partnered with talks and striking deals and pacification of rebels. But anyways, it was a very harsh narrative. Here in Idlib, situation is quite different. Here, Turkey is involved, and Turkey is quite an important partner, and also have invested heavily in its own supported groups in Syria's north, and it also has another objective, Syrian Kurds. Mm-hmm. And to follow up on that, I agree it's naive to believe, but I would also say that it is naive to believe that basically dealing with Idlib will help to finalize or, you know, get back refugees or attract, you know, investments, foreign investments.
Now, let me ask you about the sort of the language that the leaders employ, because President Erdogan, the tough cookie that he is usually very blunt in laying out his argument. And during this meeting in Tehran, he essentially said that you know, the future cooperation between Russia and Turkey depend on the outcome of the Idlib question, mm-hmm. which to me is a, you know, it's a plain blackmail. And yet President Putin, who is supposedly so much concerned about, you know, looking tough and muscular, he was very soft-spoken. He went out of his way to stress how much he agrees with President Erdogan. Why is that?
Well, again, coming back to the mere idea that Turkey is very important for Russia, both in Syria and even outside of it. So to have a NATO member country which supports your policies in the country, which counterbalancing actually its peer colleagues of North Atlantic Alliance, counterbalancing their criticism of this, I think it's quite important for Moscow. And with without having Erdogan on board with Putin's policy on Syria, with the reconstruction, with the return of refugees, then dealing with Kurds, it will be almost impossible to finalize the, you know, to bear the fruit of the Syrian campaign.
Alexei, I wonder, though, whether Turkey responds to Russia with the similar degree of understanding and accommodation. And I will give you one example. I was watching CNN Turk the other day, and they ran a report about from Idlib about a father of a household who is stocking on gas masks for his children. And that man actually said that he is in fear of a chemical attack coming not from the Syrian army, but from the Russians. And that shows to me that the Erdogan-friendly media, which CNN Turk definitely is, are quite happy with stirring the anti-Russian sentiment. There is no love lost for Moscow in Ankara, is there?
Yeah, but it's politics. I mean, there should be no surprise about that. I mean, don't forget that Turkey is not a Moscow ally. It's just a partner. It's a marriage of convenience, the same as Russia has with Iran. So let's not fool ourselves and think that Turkey will, you know, turn its back on the United States or Europe and just embrace Russia's new alliance. No, it won't happen. And this is why, I mean, it has to sticks and carrots. And this is exactly what we see during the face-to-face meetings. Yeah, we can see that both presidents respect each other. They want to negotiate. They want to find compromise.
But they also push continually.
Exactly.
Especially the Turkish president.
Both of them consider their country's powers, even not great, but regional powers for sure. And of course, that prescribes their behavior towards each other. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you specifically about this specter of yet another chemical attack in Syria. This is where the Turks and the Americans, despite all of their public disagreements, are really playing on the same side, because it was Turkey that before provided the supposed evidence on other chemical incidents. The Americans lately doubled down on the anti-Syrian rhetoric, suggesting that they actually have strong proof that the Syrian government is preparing yet another crime of this sort. Do you think Erdogan would risk whatever he has going with Putin or Russia to throw in his lot fully with the Americans?
So Turkey has been known, you know, for centuries being quite interesting and unpredictable player. So it's a good bargainer, and it uses, weak sides of its partners to, you know, trade off some great deals for itself.
Absolutely. But when you accuse your potential partner of slaughtering people with the use of chemical weapons, you know, a question soon comes politically and domestically, whether Erdogan as a president can continue, you know, negotiating with Russia if Russia indeed backs such a horrible crime.
So as far as I remember, Erdogan didn't say specifically that, you know, Russia to blame and to accuse of, you know, chemical attack.
He definitely accuses President Assad of that.
Of course. I mean, Assad, I mean, everyone can accuse Assad on that. But there was no word of criticism on Russia, or public criticism of Russia or Putin's policy in Syria, for example, when it was in Dera province. Because at the same time, or in Izgut, because at the same time Turkey had this olive branch operation in North Syria, where also smoothly it went. So also with collateral damage and with casualties among civilians, it's, so it's kind of tit for tat. And I won't say that indications that Erdogan is quite critical of Syrian regime and Bashar al-Assad doesn't mean that he blames Russia for that. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't mean that he supports Russia on its policies.
Well, Alexei, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alexei Khlebnikov, Middle East expert at the Russian International Affairs Council. Alexei, let me pick up on the point that we were discussing just before the break, the supposed chemical attack. I think all sides are now estimating the risk of it as pretty high. I mean, they all allege that the equipment, the chemicals have already been delivered to the ground. They only disagree about who is a future perpetrator is. And I think from the Russian perspective, the only means of precluding such attack from happening would be to make sure that the Syrian aviation does not operate in the area. That's the only real practical means of debasing those allegations. Do you think, though, our Western and Eastern partners would go as far as to accuse Russia of launching such an attack?
I think it's quite an unrealistic scenario. I would add to what you've said about...
But you think it's unrealistic, and yet apparently on the Turkish media there are already some fears that are being broadcast onto the large audience of Russians supposedly preparing something like that.
I think that would go... I mean, if that happens, those accusations, they will go way beyond the current kind of constellation of powers in the region, because now there is kind of like an agreement between all that no major powers, they're involved even on the ground, but they do not do some outrageous things. And that's quite clear.
There's still some etiquette. Is that what you're trying to say about the Syrian bloodshed?
Let's be serious about it. So I think it's quite unrealistic that Russia would be accused, because that would change the entire equation of negotiations. So that means if Russia commits this chemical attack, then there will be no chance that Western powers, Turkey, will negotiate with a country which commit this chemical
attack. Don't you think
attack.
That that may be an objective
a
of some powers in the West or in the East?
Right, but I think like it's not in Turkish interest, because that would mean that entire deal which is currently in works on Idlib, on north of Syria, on Kurds, it would be destroyed. And that would mean, you know, years and years of escalations and turbulence along a Turkish border in North Syria and refugees and everything.
Now, speaking about Turkish interest, what is it that Erdogan ideally wants to achieve in Idlib? Does he want to be solely in control of that province, which houses more than 3 million people, thousands of militants? That seems like too much to bargain.
Of course. I mean, in the first place, Turkish backed rebels and opposition groups, they control not entire province. And it seems that Turkey is quite ready to give back Assad the majority of the province, especially its southeastern, southwestern parts. And also, let's not forget that also Turkish-backed militias control territories in Syria's north, where Operation Olive Branch was conducted. So it's Afrin, Azaz, Al-Bab, Jarablus. And there is a Syrian National Army, I believe it's called.
Yes, and they control most of the roads and most of the entry points of the country.
Yes, exactly. So Idlib for Erdogan, it's not kind of like the last card to play or to hold. It's, he has another areas, but he definitely will, you know, do his utmost attempts to gain a maximum of Idlib.
Now, you mentioned Kurdish sensibilities of Turkey earlier, and my understanding is that Russia is trying to be attentive to those, although not at the cost of a de facto partition of Syria, even though it's not quite clear whether Turkey would be interested in that. Now, I've seen some reports in Western media about some Kurdish forces realigning themselves with the Syrian army, especially after the so-called American betrayal in the aftermath of the Afrin offensive. Do you think that is something that may be drawing Erdogan's ire and making him a little bit more concerned about where both Russians and the Syrians stand at the moment?
Yeah, that's 100% right. And it's already been held two rounds of reconciliation talks between representatives of Kurds, of PYD, and Syrian government in Damascus. So no deal yet struck, but there are good prospects for that. And also played into hand of both Syria, Damascus, and Moscow, because that actually makes Ankara more nervous and more negotiable on terms like that. Yeah, we have Russians who are partners with Damascus, and they also have quite good connections and ties with Kurds. So Russia could be a broker between Kurds and Damascus, Kurds and Turks, to finally reach a deal which will take into account concerns of both Kurds, Turks, and Syrian government.
Now, all three leaders at this Tehran meeting paid lip service to Syria's territorial integrity. Do you think, though, they conceptualize that in the same way? Do they understand that in a similar fashion?
It's quite a tricky question, because all three powers have their forces on the ground. Two of them, Russia and Iran, on official request of the Syrian government, and Turkey is not. And we can hear from Syrian media that Assad and Syrian officials call constantly Turks as occupiers and occupants, mm-hmm. Because their presence there is illegal. So I think it's just, you know, for sake of appealing to Assad's ear that, yeah, we commit to this Syrian territorial integrity, which is in fact, it's in all three actors' interests. Because if we hypothesize and that Kurds will receive autonomy or even, you know, become an independent state, that will be a precedent that will be followed by, you know, Kurds in other countries, in Iraq, in Iran, in Turkey.
But I think the Kurdish question is not the only question to consider here. I think the refugee issue is also very pressing. For example, the UN envoy on Syria, Staffan de Mistura, said the other day that there are as many as 10,000 al-Qaeda-connected militants in mm-hmm. Idlib province. And if you add to that family members, the figure could be 3-4 times as much. Mm-hmm. And the question sooner or later arises, where is that population going to be settled? Because all the powers that supported them throughout the Syrian conflict are not eager to take them in. Turkey definitely sealed its own border. Yep. It's not happy about, or it's not excited about letting in more refugees or more militants into its territory. And to play the devil's advocate to the Russian position, where do you think those people could be settled if not in some sort of an autonomous region on Turkish border? Because those people, I mean, the diehards could die hard, but that still leaves a sizable population of civilians who do not want any sort of reconciliation and any sort of the official Syrian authority on the ground.
I agree, and I think that's one of the plans in mind during negotiations, that certain area on Syrian-Turkish border would be necessary. Because, I mean, yes, as you mentioned, it's impossible. Either you need to eliminate all this 40, 50,000 Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants with their families, so it means with women, with kids, so of course it's impossible. So there should be a certain deal on that. And as far as Turkey already controls quite a prolonged area of borders with Syria and also territories in the north, so that they might serve as a transitional, you know, area of settlement of those
radicals. Do you think Russia or Syria, for that matter, or Iran, for that matter, would trust Turkey with the administering of that area?
That might be not only Turkey administered area, but also with, you know, UN observers, or not even UN observers, but Russian military police, which already played quite a positive role in Syria's north, in Golan Heights. So that might be an option.
Mm-hmm. Now, an important player here is Iran, and the Turkish-Iranian relationship is just as complicated, if not more, than the Turkish-Russian relationship. It was interesting that President Erdogan referred to President Rouhani as his brother during the summit, but surely you would agree that this brotherhood is not without its complications. What is the Iranian short-term and perhaps medium-term objective in Idlib?
I think Iran here is in the best position because, I mean, he sees his two friends kind of, you know, struggling, arguing, and he's like, you know, staying aside, observing.
A monkey watching over the two lines.
Right. And that, not particularly a monkey, but yeah.
A clever monkey.
Iran has secured his presence in Syria, 100%. The only question is that what will be the degree of Iranian military presence or economic presence in Syria. So for Iran, it's not really priority to see what happens with Idlib. But on the long run, of course, it's in Iran's interest that Damascus regain control on 100% of the territory, because that would mean more access to the Syrian territory
for
Iranians.
But it's willing to wait a little bit. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, Iran is not rushing, so yeah.
Now, both President Rouhani and President Erdogan begrudged the American presence in the Eastern Euphrates region, much more so than President Putin. Why is that? Why is Russia, at least from my perception, a little bit less objecting to the Americans being there?
In the first place, because it's Putin who will negotiating with Americans that, because I don't believe that Trump will negotiate with Rouhani on that. So, and that's kind of like Putin playing on a safe side here. So, supporting this idea that, you know, foreign forces who are illegally in Syria should be, must leave. But in the same, at the same time, he's like keeping his rhetoric quite low on that.
But one of the things that President Rouhani specifically addressed during the summit, he said that the issue of the Eastern Euphrates will have to be settled second after the Idlib question is decided. And I wonder, how can it really be settled? I mean, the Americans are not going to pack up and leave just because the Russians or even the Iranians are asking them to.
100%. And that's, I mean, from my point of view, the issue of Eastern Euphrates is way more important than Idlib. Like, yes, after Idlib Idlib is settled, and then you have, I mean, Idlib is not that much important as Eastern Euphrates for the long-term Syria's reconstruction or well-being.
Because all of the oil and gas and refineries.
Of course. And there are Kurdish areas which are well-established in terms of administration, in terms of self-governance, so they're quite sustainable. And incorporating back them into the under the Damascus control is one of the most important tasks.
Well, Alexei, it's been a wonderful and exciting conversation. Thank you very much for being with us today, and encourage our viewers to keep it going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.